Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Anne Ball, Susan Shand, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
A team of farmers, university researchers, and environmentalists is busy at work in the wetlands of eastern England. They are digging into the area's barley and wheat fields. They are looking for wet earth that could hide lost ponds underneath. The group of diggers takes just a few hours to bring one dying pond back to life. It is near Hindelvesten, a 1,000-year-old village close to the North Sea. As soon as they get water and light, they just spring to life, says Nick Anima, a farmer in nearby Dereham. He has brought 7 ponds on his property back to life. You've got frogs and toads and newts, all the insects like mayflies, dragonflies, damselflies. You can't really beat a pond, he said.
But the battle for the wetlands is a struggle. While efforts to halt losses are continuing, wetlands around the world are still being filled in and covered up. Over the past 3 centuries, almost 90% of the world's wetlands have disappeared. This information comes from the Ramsar Convention, an organization formed around a 1971 treaty to protect wetlands. The loss rate has increased since the 1970s, with wetlands now disappearing 3 times faster than the world's forests, the group says. The results of such losses can be huge, notes Ramsar. Some 5,000 wetland-dependent animal species could die off. Wetland loss can also affect human beings. Wetlands act as natural storage areas for water. Losing those areas could lead to more severe flooding in many parts of the world. And the act of removing water from wetlands can release huge amounts of carbon dioxide, a major contributor to climate change. Royal Gardner is director of the Institute for Biodiversity Law and Policy at Stetson University in the United States. We now know the value of wetlands, and we know with increasing precision how many wetlands we are losing. The next step is for the governments to act, he told the Associated Press.
A few hours of heavy rain in North Dakota are all it takes to change the dry earth of the U.S. prairie into thousands upon thousands of small wetlands. But to North Dakota farmers, these wetlands can be an enemy. The muddy areas slow down tractors and other farm equipment. They can also limit crop production. Barton Schott, a farmer, emptied several wetlands this summer to improve the fields he plans to pass on to one of his sons. Schott pointed at fields with what he called nuisance wetlands as he drove his truck down a dirt road. We have to make bushels for you guys. I just want to make the land better, he says. Nick Anima, the farmer from the beginning of this report, describes how his idea of farming differs from his father's. His father thought of the natural world as an obstacle or barrier to overcome. For Anima, farming and safeguarding the land share an important link. People had filled in a pond on Anima's farm about 150 years ago. After being dug out, seeds from long-buried water plants came back to life. I'm John Russell.
And I'm Ann Ball.
The city of Beirut in Lebanon appears to be a picture of elegance and success. It has French stores selling costly goods, pricey hotels, and its streets are filled with imported cars. But it is also a nation struggling with inequality, collapsing public services, and high unemployment. 3 weeks of anti-government protests have left the country shaken and have resulted in the resignation of Prime Minister Saad Hariri. Lebanon is a beautiful idea, said Yara Salem. She is a 25-year-old student who spends her days at the protest camp in Martyrs Square. The camp is only a few meters from the doors of Le Grey, one of Beirut's most costly hotels. You think you're in Paris, but you go over there and people are dying on the streets, she said. She was talking about the levels of poverty that exist in the city. Salem called the protests a revolution because they have brought hundreds of thousands of Lebanese people into the streets. But, she said, the protests will be a failure unless the ruling elite are removed from power completely. The country's 15-year-old civil war ended in 1990, but the names of those who run the country have not really changed, she said. The protesters do not believe they can build a stronger economy or a better future. It's been the same people for 30 years, she said. She added that her parents' generation had lost its belief in politics, but the young still believe change is possible. The main point of this revolution is to do something for the poor, jobs, services, education, she said. There are many reasons to wonder how Lebanon has been able to hold itself together for so long. With 18 officially recognized sectarian groups, it has been difficult to reach political agreement. Changing loyalties make decisions nearly impossible. Corruption touches business and politics, which are controlled by large families. The World Inequality Database, a research group, considers Lebanon one of the most unequal countries in the world. The richest 1% of its people account for almost 25% of the national income, while the poorest account for 10%. I'm Susan Shand.
About 1 year ago, the U.S. space agency NASA's Voyager 2 spacecraft left our solar system. several reports recently released in Nature Astronomy describe the spacecraft's main scientific findings. NASA says Voyager 2's mission led to new discoveries about the border that divides our solar system from interstellar space. Interstellar means between stars, but scientists define interstellar space as the place where the sun's continual flow of material and magnetic field stop affecting its surroundings. Interstellar space is estimated to be about 18 billion kilometers from Earth. Project researchers say Voyager 2's scientific instruments discovered unexpected differences in the density of plasma, a collection of charged particles existing in the solar system. NASA also says the new research reports confirmed that both Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 appear to be in a transitional area just beyond the heliosphere. The heliosphere is a protective bubble that protects our solar system. It is created by solar wind formed from charged particles. The border of the solar system, the place where solar wind ends and interstellar space begins, is called the heliopause. The team reported that data from Voyager 2 suggests that the heliopause appears to be much thinner than expected. Edward Stone is a physicist with the California Institute of Technology and a project leader for the Voyager program. Stone told reporters the findings represent a very exciting time for us. He said in a statement, the Voyager 2 mission was providing details about how the sun interacts with the materials that fill most of the space between stars in the Milky Way galaxy. Researchers said Voyager 2 also confirmed the existence of a magnetic barrier at the outer edge of the heliosphere that had been predicted by theory and observed by Voyager 1. Without this new data from Voyager 2, we wouldn't know if what we were seeing with Voyager 1 was characteristic of the entire heliosphere or specific just to the location and time when it crossed, Stone said. Leonard Berlaga is a scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center and a lead researcher on one of the reports. He told the French news agency AFP there were some surprises. Contrary to all expectations and predictions, the magnetic field direction did not change when Voyager 2 crossed the heliopause, he said. The spacecraft also collected information on incoming cosmic rays, particles that hit Earth from anywhere beyond its atmosphere. The data showed that the rays grew stronger as the Voyager explorers neared the heliopause. Voyager 2 was one of two explorers launched by NASA back in the summer of 1977. The other was Voyager 1. Both spacecraft were first designed to carry out flyby studies of Jupiter and Saturn. Later, Voyager 2 completed the first ever close observations of Uranus and Neptune. The flyby trips involving the four planets became known as the Voyager Grand Tour. The two spacecraft then began a new mission to explore areas at the edge of the sun's influence. The two Voyagers, first built to last only 5 years, have long outlasted their operational lifetimes. But after 42 years in action, both are expected to run out of power and go silent within 5 years. However, that does not mean that they will disappear. Bill Kurth, a researcher at the University of Iowa and co-writer of one of the research reports, said he expects the space explorers to outlast Earth. They are in their own orbits around the galaxy for 5 billion years or longer, he said. And the probability of them running into anything is almost zero. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Early in 1857, the United States Supreme Court announced one of its most important rulings. The High Court decided the case of a slave named Dred Scott. Harry Monroe and Leo Scully tell us about the ruling and the continuing national debate over slavery.
Dred Scott lived in Missouri, where slavery was legal. Then he was sold to a man who took him to Illinois and Wisconsin, where slavery was not legal. After 4 years, he was returned to Missouri. Dred Scott demanded his freedom because of the years he had spent in places where slavery was illegal. Congress had banned slavery in those places under the Missouri Compromise Act of 1820. The Supreme Court ruled that Congress did not have the power to close territories to slavery. It said the Missouri Compromise was a violation of the United States Constitution, and that Dred Scott was not a free man.
James Buchanan was sworn in as president at the time of the Dred Scott case. Buchanan believed the Supreme Court's decision would put an end to the dispute over slavery. He believed that Americans, North and South, would accept the decision as the final word in the dispute. This did not happen. The Dred Scott decision did not calm the storm that divided the nation. Instead, it increased its fury.
New trouble threatened to break out in the territory of Kansas between pro-slavery and anti-slavery settlers. In the past few years, the two sides had argued and fought over their opinions. They even had formed two separate governments. The pro-slavery forces controlled the legal government. The anti-slavery forces controlled an opposition government which had no power. Supporters of slavery wanted to organize a constitutional convention that could put Kansas into the Union as a slave state. The pro-slavery legislature passed a bill calling for such a convention. The bill gave supporters of slavery every chance to control the election of delegates to the convention, and it gave the convention complete freedom to make its own rules. The bill provided no way for the people of Kansas to vote on their own constitution.
The governor of the Kansas Territory, John Geary, vetoed the bill. but the legislature quickly overruled his veto. Pro-slavery men called for Geary to get out of Kansas. Some talked of shooting him if he did not leave. Governor Geary had been living under extreme tension for months. He had worked hard to keep Kansas peaceful. He was angry because he could get no help from the federal government. He sent his resignation to President Buchanan. Then the former governor spoke publicly. He said most of the settlers in Kansas were peace-loving people. He said only a small group was responsible for the trouble there. Geary said a few powerful men hoped to make Kansas a slave state. If this failed, Geary said, they hoped their actions would produce civil war.
President Buchanan appointed a new governor for Kansas. Buchanan told him that slavery in the territory must be decided on the votes of the people of the territory. And he said the people must be given a fair chance to approve or reject a constitution for statehood. The new governor arrived in Kansas at the end of May 1857. He explained his policies in a speech to the people of Kansas. The new governor promised to enforce the laws of the pro-slavery legislature, but only those laws which were constitutional. He urged everyone to vote in the coming election of delegates to the Constitutional Convention. He said he was hopeful that the convention would offer its constitution to the people for their approval or rejection. He added that Congress would not accept Kansas as a slave state or a free state until the people had voted on the question of slavery.
On June 15th, the election was held for delegates to the Constitutional Convention. Most anti-slavery men did not vote because their names had been kept off the voting lists by pro-slavery officials. Others refused to vote because they believed the election was unfair. 60 delegates were elected. All supported slavery. They planned to meet in the autumn to begin work on a constitution for Kansas. Most of the delegates were wild, rough men who found it difficult to read and write. But these men were sure of one thing. They wanted Kansas to be a slave state.
The delegates began the Constitution by claiming that the right of property was higher than any constitutional power. They said a slave owner had as much right to his property as the owner of any other kind of property. Then they wrote the different parts of the document. One part of the Constitution severely limited the right of the legislature to free slaves. Another part barred free Negroes from entering Kansas. And another prevented the Constitution from being changed for 7 years.
Most of the delegates to the Kansas Constitutional Convention wanted to send the document directly to Congress for approval. They did not want to give the people of Kansas a chance to vote on it. They were sure that the majority of the population would reject a constitution that made slavery legal. Some delegates, however,
knew that Congress would not approve statehood for Kansas unless the people voted on the Constitution. The two sides finally agreed on a compromise.
The Constitution itself would not be offered to the people. Instead, the people would vote only on the question of slavery. They could vote for the Constitution with slavery or the Constitution without slavery. If the voters approved the Constitution with slavery, then Kansas would be open to new slaves. If they approved the Constitution without slavery, then Kansas would be closed to new slaves. Slaves already in the territory could be kept there. This compromise brought a cry of anger from opponents of slavery in Kansas. They said the Constitutional Convention had only given them the right to vote for limited slavery or unlimited slavery. It had not given them the right to vote for freedom.
President Buchanan had promised the people of Kansas that they would have a fair chance to vote on their Constitution. But members of his cabinet told him to forget this promise. They said Americans were tired of the dispute in Kansas and would accept any settlement. They told Buchanan that approval of the Constitution would end the Kansas problem. It would satisfy the South, they said, and the North would soon forget about Kansas. Under this pressure, President Buchanan made his decision. He would ask Congress to accept the pro-slavery Kansas Constitution and make the territory a slave state.
In Kansas, the vote on slavery was held. Most opponents of slavery did not vote. They were waiting until they could vote against the complete statehood constitution. Many of the votes were illegal. Still, Kansas officials declared that slavery had been approved. They urged Congress to make Kansas a state under this condition. Shortly after, President Buchanan sent Congress a similar message. Buchanan's chief opponent on the statehood bill was a member of his own Democratic Party, Senator Stephen Douglas of Illinois. Douglas did not oppose slavery, but he believed that the people of a territory had the right to make their own decision to accept or reject slavery.
Stephen Douglas united other Democrats and members of the anti-slavery Republican Party to fight against the bill in the Senate. He lost. The Senate approved the bill to make Kansas a state where slavery was legal. The House of Representatives, however, rejected the bill. Instead, it approved a bill to let the people of Kansas vote again on their statehood constitution. The Senate approved a compromise version of this House bill.
So the people of Kansas got another chance to show that they did not want a pro-slavery constitution. They voted and rejected the Constitution by a large majority. The pro-slavery statehood constitution was dead. Kansas would continue as a territory for a few more years. But there would be no further attempt to make it a slave state.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.